this too.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
KBOO is proud to present one of the greatest jazz films ever made, Round Midnight. Join us Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for this 1986 American-French film that captured the Paris jazz scene of the 1950s. Watch jazz legend Dexter Gordon deliver an Oscar-nominated performance. Round Midnight, the Clinton Street Theater, Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m., 2522 Southeast Clinton.
In conjunction with KBOO's presentation of Round Midnight at the Clinton Street Theater, tune in Wednesday afternoon, December 11, when KBOO jazz host Rita Rega talks with bassist Chuck Israels about his experiences in the Paris jazz scene in the 1950s, playing with pianist Bud Powell, the real-life inspiration for the film. That's Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, between noon and 2 p.m. on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
At KBOO, we have a dynamic community of 500 volunteers doing everything from front desk work, janitorial work, community reporting, hosting information booths, clerical support, news writing, documentary making, engineering live music, operating soundboards, working in the music library, and many, many other things. KBOO absolutely depends on volunteers to carry out the work of the station. We are always looking for new volunteers. We have monthly volunteer orientations, which is the first step in getting involved. Contact KBOO Volunteer Coordinator Ani Haynes about the next volunteer orientation at 503-231-8032 extension 231 or at volunteer@kboo.org.
Responding to listener and community requests, we are engaging in a trial period of broadcasting the Tom Hartman Show from 4 to 5 p.m. each weekday. We take seriously the feedback we have received from listeners, non-listeners, KBOO members, and volunteers. This trial period is both an attempt to present the program, which is currently unavailable on broadcast media in the Portland area, and to solicit feedback on how appropriate this program is for KBOO. Please call 503-231-8032 or write to program@kboo.org with your opinion.
The time is 6:03, and we are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio. Please stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6, and at 6:30 is Prison Pipeline, followed by Hard Knock Radio at 7.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Oregon Council 75, representing over 25,000 Oregon public and private sector employees, families, and communities, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members since 1942. More information at www.OregonAFSCME.com.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Hello, this is Labor Radio on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. News and views of, by, and for the working people. I'm Meredith, standing in for Fourth Monday hosts
Jamie and John, who are busy covering other stories. We kick this week off after an impressive 2,000-person turnout at the Burnside Bridge on Friday, November 22nd, in support of Portland Public School teachers. Check out our Labor Radio Facebook page for more links about the event and updates on future actions. Tonight's interview is from Labor Radio special correspondent in Seattle, Darren Hoop, a Seattle labor writer for socialistworker.org. He's speaking with David Clay, a machinist, about the recent union vote at Boeing. On Monday, November 11th, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee signed an $8.7 billion tax cut for Boeing. This is the largest state tax break for a private corporation in U.S. history. Without this taxpayer subsidy and without union concessions, Boeing threatened to outsource more work to other states and other countries, as it has done repeatedly in the past, despite tax deals. But on Wednesday, November 13th, members of the Puget Sound Machinists Union voted down the proposal from Boeing aimed squarely at wages, retirement benefits, and limitations on workplace actions in exchange for building the next plane model at the campus in Everett, Washington. The 8-year contract extension was rejected by the rank-and-file union members, despite pressure from the top of the union and political leaders.
Okay, if you could let everyone know your name and where you work, how long you've been there, whatever you'd like to tell people in terms of your jobs, your history at the company.
My name is David Clay. I've been at Boeing Everett for 36 years. I'm a toolmaker. I'm a longtime union activist. I was a local lodge officer, governmental affairs chair, district lodge officer. I ran for district office twice against the incumbents. I'm currently not involved any longer with the union.
The contract proposal between Boeing management and the union leadership that was just voted down by a 67% margin, more or less a 2-to-1 margin. Why do you think there was such a resounding no vote?
I think that the membership, the rank-and-file membership, saw through the takeaways and didn't see anything that was going to be of benefit to themselves now or to their families in the future. They turned it down. There was supposedly this was a surprise that just happened within the last week that the company dropped on the union leadership. But in fact, Saturday, the 16th of November, Tom Buffenberger, the international president, came out and said that they've been working on this for months with the company, along with the district lodge president, Tom Rubluski, and Mark Johnson, the aerospace coordinator. So our inclination, you know, the feeling we got was that there was something being cooked up in the back room, just like the prior contract extension where we weren't informed of anything. It was just dropped on us. And then we were asked to vote. And it's more, you know, it felt like it was blackmail. You either take this or we're going someplace else. And the membership just said, go for it. You know, we're not going to hurt our families now, or we're not going to hurt the community in the future by accepting this takeaway contract.
Could you talk a little bit about what some of the key concessions were that everyone was opposed to?
I think number one, and this is like an issue that was meant to divide the membership, the new hires from the people who have been there a long time, because the demographics at the company now are, you know, there's probably, it's 60-40 people who have been there 25 plus years, and people have just been hired in the last 5 years. And it would have, after 2016, there wouldn't have been a defined pension program any longer. And you know, people wondered, well, what's going to happen to that money, you know, and they were taking a look at, you know, how that would hurt the people coming in, as well as the people that had, you know, been there for decades, what would happen to their pension under this new plan that the company was offering. The other thing was the medical premiums. Our coverage was going to decline, the premiums would increase. And they were offering a supposed $10,000 bonus, but you know these huge bonuses, after taxes, it's not going to cover the increases on our medical. So I think, you know, there are key, those are two key issues, the takeaways on the retirement and the medical. And a huge one for, you know, that everybody considered was it was going to take, you know, today it takes about 6 years for somebody to go from entry level wages to maximum wages. But, you know, within 3 months, you're doing, if you're a new hire, you're doing the same thing as a guy next to you that's been there for 25 years, but you're making less than half. You know, people don't understand, you know, the news, corporate news media is always talking about all the money that we make, you know, and they put these large figures out there. I heard that the average Boeing worker makes $82,000 a year, which is not true. The new hires are making, you know, starting wage something like $14 an hour, and it's going to take them today 6 years to get to their maximum pay grade. Under this contract extension blackmail offer, it would have been 16 years, you know, to go from entry level. And it doesn't just affect us. Once this company gets something like that, a concession like that, people in other industries, you know, people that work at the grocery store, people that work at the post office, people that work any job, now they're gonna try and do the same thing to their workers, especially non-union workplaces. And some, you know, all these young people or anybody entering the labor market, it's going to take them close to two decades to go from, you know, entry level to maximum wage. And that was a big one. We just felt that the company was drawing a line in the sand, and you know, it was an ultimatum, and it really felt like a bully saying, "Give me your lunch money or I'm going to thump you." Well, go, you know, we said, go for it, you know, and we said, no.
Back to the contract. So you all struck in 2008, a 4-year contract was signed. And then in December of 2011, the union and the company opened the contract and signed an extension, which is what we're now dealing with now, this a second extension to the previous extension. Was there a precedent to what happened in 2011 where management and the union, short of when the contract was supposed to expire, negotiated an extension?
There's absolutely no precedent for that, and there was no need for it either. We're still wondering about that, you know, the validity of that whole episode. But I've been here for 36 years. I've never seen or heard of anything like that in any industry, let alone our own.
Do you have thoughts on, given that precedent was set in 2011 and the union agreed to it, would it be safe to say, or do you have any thoughts on how that laid the groundwork for this mega extension of 8 years?
Well, anytime you open the door, you know, to let the bad news in, you know, that sets the precedent. I mean, at any time, you know, that's one of the reasons why we turned this contract offer, contract extension, blackmail, whatever you want to call it, this past week, why we turned it down, was what we thought was, okay, well, we already did this once. And so now anytime the company wants to introduce a new model variant or anything they want to do, what are they going to do? Just call for a vote, call for another contract extension. It'll be never ending. If we hadn't have said no, then this precedent would have continued on. I think we were caught blindsided the last time, you know, in 2011. But we realized that here we weren't asking for anything. We weren't asking for anything back then. And just like I said, you know, these promises that are made of jobs don't necessarily pan out. And why, you know, slaves had jobs. Why are we trading? Why would we trade away our future or our children's future for a negative? You know?
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about in 2003. The Washington State Legislature passed $3.2 billion worth of tax breaks for Boeing to keep work here. Seems like that set a precedent for what just took place around the same time as the contract vote, where the state, backed by Democratic Governor Inslee, called a special session and passed $8.7 billion in tax breaks over the next 16 years, which extended tax breaks that were going to expire in 2024, I believe, to the year 2040. Do you have any opinions on the initial tax breaks that were set in the early 2000s and the precedent that it set for this time? Any general opinions on this?
Well, what I remember about the first set of tax breaks was that those were done to ensure that the new aircraft would be built here in Washington State.
Which new aircraft?
The 787. But, you know, as we soon found out, it wasn't. They, despite the fact that we'd given them those huge tax breaks in the state as a quid pro quo for building it here, they moved it out of state. So, you know, there's a lesson learned there that we didn't learn it.
I was wondering if you had an opinion on, at the same time that the state is promising $8.7 billion in tax breaks going up to 2040 in King County, the Metro Transit Service is saying unless they get more funding from the state, they're going to have to cut literally 70-some routes and 100, you know, 100-plus others are going to have lesser service. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on the connections between all of a sudden there's billions of dollars for Boeing tax breaks, but yet social services like mass transit are being cut.
Well, I think it's all very short-sighted, and people in general in the community must be wondering, you know, how that can be, because we don't have enough money to fund what we have now, and now we're going to take $8.7 billion out of the kitty. How are we going to do that? And it's not just about the transportation. It's a number of services that go to the community that money is not going to be there any longer for when this corporation is making mega profits, the most profits it's ever made in its history. And in doing this, it's like the next time they say jump, all our legislators are going to go, how high? How high? That's what they did now. Mm-hmm. So what is the return on our investment as taxpayers, as citizens in this community for doing something like this? Because it's great for this one entity, but what about the farmers in Eastern Washington, or what about the rest of the people in the community that rely on services like mass transit? And there's not enough of it now.
You're listening to Labor Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. Seattle correspondent Darren Hoop is speaking with David Clay about the recent machinist vote against Boeing's request for concessions.
The $15 minimum wage, I was curious if you had any opinions on that. SeaTac had an initiative that, still too close to call, hasn't been officially ratified, but was up by 40 or so votes at one point recently. And then it looks like the city of Seattle just elected a socialist to the city council, and one of her main platforms is $15 minimum wage. Do you have any thoughts or any opinions in terms of, you know, outside of the union issue for a second, political alternatives? Because we see it was a Democratic Governor Inslee that cut this deal. I think that one of the pictures you were referring to was a picture of the IAM local president Wroblewski with Senator Patty Murray, Governor Jay Inslee, the Governor Jay Inslee, and Ray Conner, the commercial airline CEO. Do you have any thoughts on what just happened in terms of the election? And do you feel like that had any effect in terms of your coworkers? Did it inspire people, give people sense that like what's happening here up in Everett area is connected at all to some of these other things taking place?
Well, I don't know. You know, the connection that can be drawn is that I think people's eyes are being opened to the corporate greed, mm-hmm. right? And that there needs to be more equitable, a more equitable system. Mm-hmm. I think it's becoming more apparent that, you know, we're a two-party system, and you know, that's not enough. It's not two parties. It's really one party. One party is going too far to kowtow to business, and they're not looking after the people. The other party is definitely totally pro-business. And now those people are going off the edge somewhere, too, with their radicals within. It's kind of like people are just starting to open their eyes a little bit, but it's a big machine out there, you know, a big media machine that tries to drown out, you know, these voices of, you know, calling for equity, voices that are calling for social justice. But I think that this enlightened the membership, both the, you know, reminded the people, excuse me, reminded the people that have been around for a while of why they stand up and fight. And it's reminding the young people, or teaching the young people, you know, we can stand up and fight. So you know, what kind of conclusion are we going to draw from that? You know, I'm hopeful that there's more that there's more people that will enter the public service that have more of a social consciousness. I think that, you know, I don't have a problem with socialism. I think that we have a lot of, I think that this country has a lot of socialist programs in work that have worked well for us, you know, Social Security and pensions and you know, welfare for people that need it, you know, public education, transportation. It's all socialist, you know, and it could go further because, you know, what I think that the last few years since 2008, especially, where we see the robber barons alive and well, you know, the banksters and that whole fiasco, I think people are getting, you know, more of a conscious awakening that there has to be something better because what's good for business isn't necessarily good for the citizens or the community. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, they're working against us just to line their own pockets. And I would hope that the, you know, the Occupy movement would, you know, be more organized, revitalized, and raise the consciousness. But like I said, you know, the media machine that's out there, you know, drowns out those voices.
Mm-hmm. Dana Cloud wrote what I thought was an excellent book about the 1995 Boeing strike, and I know she interviewed and some of the other folks. And one of her critiques of some of the strategies that you all used was putting too much focus on the union elections and not enough on building a lasting rank and file organization that's always drawing in new people. So in terms of if a new group gets off the ground, what did you think about some of those critiques that she raised and lessons maybe learned about the balance between running for elections and also actually building a long lasting rank and file group with members who can live beyond and organize beyond whatever elections come up for the union, you know, continue to organize on the shop floor at Boeing.
Well, that's, I think that critique is probably, you know, correct and has some value, but, you know, it gets to where, you know, you don't have to be in office to move the leadership. Just like we did this week, right? Mm-hmm. That's a huge movement that was led by the people and just indiscriminate people, you know, no particular one leader. Mm-hmm. And we did a huge thing, you know, together. So you don't need to be in office, but what happens is, you know, you see that things aren't moving. I mean, there are people within the group that become, not necessarily because they want to be the leader, but they become the leader because people make them the leader. You know, circumstances make those people leaders. And then, you know, the option there is, you know, I mean, if you're not able to drive things as quickly or as effectively, you know, as a rank and file movement, you know, the option is to do it from the top, you know, to actually be a person that's in, you know, in a position, you know, on district council or a local lodge officer or the district president or the secretary treasurer. So it very may well be that people, you know, build a, you know, a shop floor movement, and that could happen. But at some point, leaders rise from those movements. Mm-hmm. And they're going to, you know, people are going to want them to be in office, you know. But I mean, like I said, you know, this is a pretty tight closed door system, and some things need to be overcome, you know, to ever get in there. Mm-hmm. But you can drive and not have, you know, be the one, you know, sitting in the driver's seat. Mm-hmm. You can make the person in the driver's seat go where you want to go if you've got the energy, you know, from the shop floor.
Mm-hmm. And then you were part of a group called Machinists for Solidarity. What are the lessons in terms of, you know, there were three different groups at one point within the same company, and it is a big company, but I guess one question would be, why were there different groups? And then my understanding is that there was later on some unity, some bridges that were repaired. So I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that history of why separate groups initially, and then how was some of that overcome?
Well, I think that that we had the different groups had a common a common goal of making things better or making things more inclusive, but we had different views on how to get it done. And I think that worked to the advantage of to our disadvantage and to the advantage of the incumbents, because we didn't work together. And you know, we were able to mend some fences, you know, down the road, but you know, times change, people's lives change. What I see now is over the past week is a lot of new people, you know, that have their eyes open and they've got a lot of energy, and they're the ones that drove this vote no on the blackmail. And I think that there's an opportunity there for those people to make some change. I hope that they're able to overcome whatever there are a lot of personal differences, personalities clashing, you know, between those different groups. I wasn't necessarily as the group that I led wasn't necessarily as radical, you know, as some of the other groups. I was hoping for change within, you know. I was willing to work with some of the people that were already in place, because I thought that they had some value and they knew the process. I didn't think that everybody was evil. That wasn't the thought patterns of some of the other groups. But in retrospect, they were all evil. So, you know, I should have been not so trusting, you know, of the incumbents. And you know, I learned some big lessons. But I'm hopeful that those people that are coming up now and willing to work for some change within their union leadership, that they're able to get beyond, you know, the things that stymied us.
Has there been any discussion, or what do you think the prospects are for not just sort of the general reform the union, but specifically trying to rebuild a rank and file reform organization off of one of the models that took place before? Do you think are those discussions taking place? Do you think there's some potential for that now?
Oh, I think they're beyond discussions. I think people are organizing it, and I think there's ample opportunity for it to happen. And I think, you know, what happened at the union meetings this past week in turning down the blackmail with a big no vote, I think that's all part of it. And I don't think that this is over by any means. I think it's just started.
Mm-hmm. Lastly, is there any final things that you want to say, either lessons that you've learned or things you think that people should know, whether it's from this most recent struggle or the wealth of experience over the last 36 years, that you would want new generations of workers who are trying to organize to know from your experiences?
Well, you know, I've always thought that and you know, I love reading history, and you know, this isn't about a sprint. This is a marathon. And, you know, battles aren't won in miles or won in inches. So you have to keep in mind, and I think this is what happened to some of the rank and file groups, is that they forgot where they started and where they were at, you know, and how far that they had come. You know, we've been pushing on a rock wall here for a long time, and it's moved. You know, we've moved it. And if we only got an inch is as good as a mile, because it wasn't moving to begin with, you know, and we got it to move an inch. So I think you just have to take every inch that you win as a victory. Don't ever think you're going to win the whole war, you know, because in your whole lifetime, and you know, I've spent pretty much the majority of my lifetime at this, and you know, I won't see the end of it. You know, I never expected to. So I just think you have to keep your eyes on the prize, and you have to think in those kinds of terms that you know, like if you gain, you know, I used to think, you know, the first thing I ever worked on in this union was the overtime issue. And they told me, well, we've been here since 1935, and this was in 1980. They said, we never got that language. I said, we're going to get it. And I was nobody, you know, I was just a new hire. And I just, you know, just went every place I could and talked this issue and talked this issue. And by God, you know, in the 1980 contract, we got the first language in history to limit the amount of overtime and get rid of forced overtime. So, you know, I mean, you could do amazing things. You just have to remember where you're coming from, where you've made it to, and don't give up.
That was Labor Radio, Seattle correspondent Darren Hoop speaking with machinist David Clay. You can find the recording of tonight's program online at kboo.fm/laborradio. You can also find details about upcoming labor events on our Facebook page, KBOO Labor Radio. The annual Black Friday protests against Walmart, the PAT Solidarity Campaign, you can find it on our Facebook page, KBOO Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Triangle production of American Fiesta, starring Gary Wayne Cash, a witty, hopeful tale of imperfection and acceptance. American Fiesta will take place at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This Triangle production will run from November 29th through December 22nd. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in Wednesday at 9 a.m. for a special political perspectives show. Teresa Mitchell will interview Michael Kimmel, author of Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era. Hear about Michael Kimmel's research interviewing a variety of angry white men, from white supremacists to men's rights activists to schoolboys, to try to figure out what makes them so furious. That's Wednesday at 9 a.m. right here on KBOO Portland.
KBOO is proud to present one of the greatest jazz films ever made, Round Midnight. Join us Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for this 1986 American-French